Then dreadful was their plight, and hardly would it have been saved by the deathless valour of yellow-haired Glorfindel, chief of the House of the Golden Flower of Gondolin, had not Thorondor come timely to their aid. Songs have been sung of the duel of Glorfindel with the Balrog upon a pinnacle of rock in that high place, and both fell to ruin in the abyss. But Thorondor bore up Glorfindel's body, and he was buried in a mound of stones beside the pass, and there came after a turf of green, and small flowers like yellow stars bloomed there amid the barrenness of stone. And the birds of Thorondor stooped upon the orcs and drove them shrieking back, and all were slain or cast into the deeps, and rumour of the escape from Gondolin came not until long after to Morgoth's ears. Thus by weary and dangerous marches the remnant of Gondolin came unto Nantathrin, and there rested a while and were healed of their hurts and weariness, but their sorrow could not be cured. There they made feast in memory of Gondolin and those that had perished, fair maidens, wives, and warriors, and their king. But for Glorfindel, the well-beloved, many and sweet were the songs they sang. And there Tuor spoke in song to Eärendil his son of the coming of Ulmo aforetime, the sea vision in the midst of the land. And the sea longing awoke in his heart and in his sons. Wherefore they removed with the most part of the people to the mouths of Sirion by the sea, and there they dwelt, and joined their folk to the slender company of Elwing, daughter of Dior, that had fled thither a little while before. Then Morgoth thought in his heart that his triumph was fulfilled, recking little of the sons of Feanor and of their oath, which had harmed him never and turned always to his mightiest aid. And in his black thought he laughed, regretting not the one Silmaril he had lost, for by it he deemed the last shreds of the elvish race should vanish yet from the earth and trouble it no more. If he knew of the dwelling by the waters of Sirion, he made no sign, biding his time, and waiting upon the working of oath and lie. Yet by Sirion and the sea there grew up an elven folk, the gleanings of Gondolin and Doriath, and they took to the waves and to the making of fair ships, dwelling ever nigh unto the shores and under the shadow of Ulmo's hand.
We are now at the same place in the story of Gondolin, in the Quenta Noldorinua, as that reached in the sketch of the mythology. Here I will leave the Quenta and turn to the last major text of the story of Gondolin, which is also the last account of the foundation of Gondolin, and of how Tuor came to enter the city. The Last Version. Many years passed between the story of Gondolin as told in the Quenta Noldorinua and this text entitled Of Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin. It is certain that it was written in 1951. See the evolution of the story.
Rian, wife of Huor, dwelt with the people of the House of Hador. But when rumour came to Dor Lomin of the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad, the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, and yet she could hear no news of her lord, she became distraught and wandered forth into the wild alone. There she would have perished, but the grey elves came to her aid. For there was a dwelling of this people in the mountains westward of Lake Mithrim, and thither they led her. And she was there delivered of a son before the end of the year of lamentation. And Rian said to the elves, Let him be called Tuor, for that name his father chose ere war came between us. And I beg of you to foster him, and to keep him hidden in your care, for I forebode that great good for elves and men shall come from him. But I must go in search of Huor, my lord. Then the elves pitied her. But one Anael, who alone of all that went to war from that people had returned from the Nirnaeth, said to her, Alas, lady, it is known now that Huor fell at the side of Hurin his brother, and he lies, I deem, in the great hill of slain that the orcs have raised upon the field of battle. Therefore Rhian arose and left the dwelling of the elves, and she passed through the land of Mithrim and came at last to the Houth en Ndengin, in the waste of Anfauglith, and there she laid her down and died. But the elves cared for the infant son of Huor, and Tuor grew up among them, and he was fair of face, and golden-haired after the manner of his father's kin, and he became strong and tall and valiant, and being fostered by the elves he had lore and skill no less than the princes of the Edain, ere ruin came upon the north. But with the passing of the years the life of the former folk of Hithlum, such as still remained, elves or men, became ever harder and more perilous. For, as is elsewhere told, Morgoth broke his pledges to the Easterlings that had served him, and he denied to them the rich lands of Beleriand which they had coveted. And he drove away these evil folk into Hithlum, and there commanded them to dwell. And though they loved Morgoth no longer, they served him still in fear, and hated all the elven folk, and they despised the remnant of the house of Hador, the aged in women and children for the most part. And they oppressed them, and wedded their women by force, and took their lands and goods, and enslaved their children. Orcs came and went about the land as they would, pursuing the lingering elves into the fastnesses of the mountains, and taking many captive to the mines of Angband, to labour as the thralls of Morgoth. Therefore Anael led his small people to the caves of Androth, and there they lived a hard and weary life, until Tuor was 16 years of age and was become strong and able to wield arms, the axe and bow of the grey elves. And his heart grew hot within him at the tale of the griefs of his people, and he wished to go forth and avenge them on the orcs and Easterlings. But Anael forbade this. "Far hence, I deem, your doom lies, Tuor, son of Huor," he said. "And this land shall not be freed from the shadow of Morgoth until Thangorodrim itself be overthrown. Therefore we are resolved at last to forsake it, and to depart into the south, and with us you shall go." "But how shall we escape the net of our enemies?" said Tuor, "for the marching of so many together will surely be marked." "We shall not march through the land openly," said Anael. "And if our fortune is good, we shall come to the secret way which we call Anon in Gelith, the gate of the Noldor. For it was made by the skill of that people long ago in the days of Turgon." At that name Tuor was stirred, though he knew not why. And he questioned Anael concerning Turgon. "He is a son of Fingolfin," said Anael, "and is now accounted High King of the Noldor since the fall of Fingon. For he lives yet, most feared of the foes of Morgoth, and he escaped from the ruin of the Nirnaeth, when Húrin of Dol Lomín and Huor your father held the passes of Sirion behind him." "Then I will go and seek Turgon," said Tuor, "for surely he will lend me aid for my father's sake." "That you cannot," said Anael, "for his stronghold is hidden from the eyes of elves and men, and we know not where it stands. Of the Noldor some, maybe, know the way thither, but they will speak of it to none. Yet if you would have speech with them, then come with me as I bid you, for in the far havens of the south you may meet with wanderers from the hidden kingdom." Thus it came to pass that the elves forsook the caves of Androth, and Tuor went with them. But their enemies kept watch upon their dwellings, and were soon aware of their march, and they had not gone far from the hills into the plain before they were assailed by a great force of orcs and Easterlings, and they were scattered far and wide, fleeing into the gathering night. But Tuor's heart was kindled with the fire of battle, and he would not flee, but boy as he was, he wielded the axe as his father before him. And for long he stood his ground and slew many that assailed him, but at the last he was overwhelmed and taken captive, and led before Lorgan the Easterling. Now this Lorgan was held the chief of the Easterlings, and claimed to rule all Dol Lomín as a fief under Morgoth. and he took Tuor to be his slave. Hard and bitter then was his life, for it pleased Lorgan to treat Tuor the more evilly as he was of the kin of the former lords, and he sought to break, if he could, the pride of the house of Hador. But Tuor saw wisdom, and endured all pains and taunts with watchful patience, so that in time his lot was somewhat lightened, and at the least he was not starved, as were many of Lorgan's unhappy thralls. For he was strong and skilful, and Lorgan fed his beasts of burden well, while they were young and could work. But after 3 years of thraldom, Tuor saw at last a chance of escape. He was come now almost to his full stature, taller and swifter than any of the Easterlings, and being sent with other thralls on an errand of labour into the woods, he turned suddenly on the guards and slew them with an axe, and fled into the hills. The Easterlings hunted him with dogs, but without avail, for well nigh all the hounds of Lorgan were his friends, and if they came up with him they would fawn upon him, and then run homeward at his command. Thus he came back at last to the caves of Androth, and dwelt there alone. And for 4 years he was an outlaw in the land of his fathers, grim and solitary. And his name was feared, for he went often abroad, and slew many of the Easterlings that he came upon. Then they set a great price upon his head, but they did not dare to come to his hiding place, even with strength of men, for they feared the elven folk, and shunned the caves where they had dwelt. Yet it is said that Tuor's journeys were not made for the purpose of vengeance. Rather he sought ever for the gate of the Noldor, of which Anael had spoken. But he found it not, for he knew not where to look, and such few of the elves as lingered in the mountains had not heard of it. Now Tuor knew that though fortune still favoured him, yet in the end the days of an outlaw are numbered, and are ever few and without hope. Nor was he willing to live thus for ever a wild man in the houseless hills, and his heart urged him ever to great deeds. Herein it is said the power of Ulmo was shown, for he gathered tidings of all that passed in Beleriand, and every stream that flowed from Middle-earth to the great sea was to him a messenger both to and fro. And he remained also in friendship, as of old, with Círdan and the shipwrights at the mouths of Sirion. And at this time, most of all, Ulmo gave heed to the fates of the house of Hador. For in his deep counsels he purposed that they should play great part in his designs for the succour of the exiles. And he knew well of the plight of Tuor, for Anael and many of his folk had indeed escaped from Dor Lomin, and come at last to Círdan in the far south.
This is Círdan the shipwright, who appears in The Lord of the Rings as the Lord of the Grey Havens at the end of the Third Age.
Thus it came to pass that on a day in the beginning of the year, 23 since the near Naeth, Tuor sat by a spring that trickled forth near to the door of the cave where he dwelt, and he looked out westward towards the cloudy sunset. Then suddenly it came into his heart that he would wait no longer, but would arise and go. "I will leave now the grey land of my kin that are no more," he cried, "and I will go in search of my doom. But whither shall I turn? Long have I sought the gate and found it not." Then he took up the harp which he bore ever with him, being skilled in playing upon its strings, and heedless of the peril of his clear voice alone in the waste, he sang an elven song of the north for the uplifting of hearts. And even as he sang, the well at his feet began to boil with great increase of water, and it overflowed, and a rill ran noisily down the rocky hillside before him. And Tuor took this as a sign, and he arose at once and followed after it. Thus he came down from the tall hills of Mithrim, and passed out into the northward plain of Dor Lomin. And ever the stream grew as he followed it westward, until after 3 days he could descry in the west the long grey ridges of Ered Lomin, that in those regions marched north and south, fencing off the far coastlands of the western shores. To those hills, in all his journeys, Tuor had never come. Now the land became more broken and stony again as it approached the hills, and soon it began to rise before Tuor's feet, and the stream went down into a cloven bed. But even as dim dusk came on the third day of his journey, Tuor found before him a wall of rock, and there was an opening therein like a great arch, and the stream passed in and was lost. Then Tuor was dismayed, and he said, "So my hope has cheated me. The sign in the hills has led me only to a dark end in the midst of the land of my enemies." And grey at heart he sat among the rocks on the high bank of the stream, keeping watch through a bitter, fireless night. For it was yet but the month of Sulime, and no stir of spring had come to that far northern land, and a shrill wind blew from the east. But even as the light of the coming sun shone pale in the far mists of Mithrim, Tuor heard voices, and looking down he saw in amazement two elves that waded in the shallow water, and as they climbed up steps hewn in the bank, Tuor stood up and called to them. At once they drew their bright swords and sprang towards him. Then he saw that they were grey-cloaked, but mail-clad under, and he marvelled, for they were fairer and more fell to look upon, because of the light of their eyes, than any of the elven folk that he yet had known. He stood to his full height and awaited them. But when they saw that he drew no weapon, but stood alone and greeted them in the elven tongue, they sheathed their swords and spoke courteously to him. And one said, "Gelmir and Arminas we are, of Finarfin's people. Are you not one of the Edain of old, that dwelt in these lands ere the Nirnaeth, and indeed of the kindred of Hador and Húrin I deem you, for so the gold of your head declares you?" And Tuor answered, "Yea, I am Tuor, son of Huor, son of Galdor, son of Hador. But now at last I desire to leave this land where I am outlawed and kinless." "Then," said Gelmir, "if you would escape and find the havens in the south, already your feet have been guided on the right road." "So I thought," said Tuor, "for I followed a sudden spring of water in the hills until it joined this treacherous stream. But now I know not whither to turn, for it has gone into darkness."
"Through darkness one may come to the light," said Gelmir.
"Yet one will walk under the sun while one may," said Tuor. "But since you are of that people, tell me if you can where lies the gate of the Noldor, for I have sought it long, ever since Anaeol, my foster-father of the Grey Elves, spoke of it to me." Then the elves laughed and said, "Your search is ended, for we have ourselves just passed that gate. There it stands before you." And they pointed to the arch into which the water flowed. "Come now, through darkness you shall come to the light. We will set your feet on the road, but we cannot guide you far, for we are sent back to the lands whence we fled upon an urgent errand." "But fear not," said Gelmir. "A great doom is written upon your brow, and it shall lead you far from these lands, far indeed from Middle-earth, as I guess." Then Tuor followed the Noldor down the steps and waded in the cold water, until they passed into the shadow beyond the arch of stone. And then Gelmir brought forth one of those lamps for which the Noldor were renowned, for they were made of old in Valinor, and neither wind nor water could quench them, and when they were unhooded they sent forth a clear blue light from a flame imprisoned in white crystal. Now by the light that Gelmir held above his head, Tuor saw that the river began to go suddenly down a smooth slope into a great tunnel. But beside its rock-hewn course there ran long flights of steps, leading on and downward into a deep gloom beyond the beam of the lamp. When they had come to the foot of the rapids, they stood under a great dome of rock, and there the river rushed over a steep fall with a great noise that echoed in the vault, and it passed then on again under another arch into a further tunnel. Beside the falls the Noldor halted and bade Tuor farewell.
"Now we must return and go our ways with all speed," said Gelmir, "for matters of great peril are moving in Beleriand."
"Is then the hour when Turgon shall come forth?" said Tuor.
Then the elves looked at him in amazement.
"That is a matter which concerns the Noldor rather than the sons of men," said Arminas. "What know you of Turgon?"
"Little," said Tuor, "save that my father aided his escape from the Nirnaeth, and that in his stronghold dwells the hope of the Noldor. Yet, though I know not why, ever his name stirs in my heart and comes to my lips, and had I my will I would go in search of him rather than tread this dark way of dread, unless perhaps this secret road is the way to his dwelling."
"Who shall say?" answered the elf. "For since the dwelling of Turgon is hidden, so also are the ways thither. I know them not, though I have sought them long. Yet if I knew them, I would not reveal them to you, nor to any among men." But Gelmir said, "I have heard that your house has the favour of the Lord of Waters, and if his counsels lead you to Turgon, then surely shall you come to him, whithersoever you turn. Follow now the road to which the water has brought you from the hills, and fear not. You shall not walk long in darkness. Farewell, and think not that our meeting was by chance, for the dweller in the deep moves many things in this land still. Anar Kaluva Tieliana, the sun will shine upon your path." With that the Noldor turned and went back up the long stairs, but Tuor stood still until the light of their lamp was lost, and he was alone in a darkness deeper than night amid the roaring of the falls. Then, summoning his courage, he set his left hand to the rock wall and felt his way forward, slowly at first, and then more quickly, as he became more used to the darkness and found nothing to hinder him. And after a great while, as it seemed to him, when he was weary and yet unwilling to rest in the black tunnel, he saw far before him a light. And hastening on, he came to a tall and narrow cleft, and followed the noisy stream between its leaning walls, out into a golden evening. For he was come into a deep ravine with tall, sheer sides, and it ran straight towards the west. And before him the setting sun, going down through a clear sky, shone into the ravine and kindled its walls with yellow fire, and the waters of the river glittered like gold as they broke and foamed upon many gleaming stones. In that deep place Tuor went on now in great hope and delight, finding a path beneath the southern wall, where there lay a long and narrow strand, and when night came and the river rushed on unseen, save for a glint of high stars mirrored in dark pools, then he rested and slept, for he felt no fear beside that water, in which the power of Ulmo ran. With the coming of day he went on again without haste. The sun rose behind his back and set before his face, and where the water foamed among the boulders or rushed over sudden falls, at morning and evening rainbows were woven across the stream. Wherefore he named that stream Kirith Niniach, Rainbow Cleft. Thus Tuor journeyed slowly for 3 days, drinking the cold water but desiring no food, though there were many fish that shone as gold or silver, or gleamed with colours like to the rainbows in the spray above. And on the 4th day the channel grew wider, and its walls lower and less sheer, but the river ran deeper and more strongly, for high hills now marched on either side, and fresh waters spilled from them into Kirith Niniach over shimmering falls. There long while Tuor sat, watching the swirling of the stream and listening to its endless voice, until night came again
and stars shone cold and white in the dark lane of sky above him. Then he lifted up his voice and plucked the strings of his harp. And above the noise of the water, the sound of his song and the sweet thrilling of the harp were echoed in the stone and multiplied, and went forth and rang in the night-clad hills, until all the empty land was filled with music beneath the stars. For though he knew it not, Tuor was now come to the echoing mountains of Lamoth, about the firth of Drengist. There once, long ago, Feanor had landed from the sea, and the voices of his host were swelled to a mighty clamour upon the coasts of the north, ere the rising of the moon. Then Tuor was filled with wonder and stayed his song, and slowly the music died in the hills, and there was silence. And then amid the silence he heard in the air above him a strange cry, and he knew not of what creature that cry came. Now, he said, it is a fey voice. Nay, it is a small beast that is wailing in the waste. And then hearing it again, he said, surely it is the cry of some night-faring bird that I know not. And it seemed to him a mournful sound, and yet he desired nonetheless to hear it and follow it, for it called him, he knew not whither. The next morning he heard the same voice above his head, and looking up he saw three great white birds beating down the ravine against the westerly wind, and their strong wings shone in the new-risen sun, and as they passed over him they wailed aloud. Thus for the first time he beheld the great gulls, beloved of the Teleri. Then Tuor arose to follow them, and so that he might better mark whither they flew, he climbed the cliff upon his left hand and stood upon the top, and felt a great wind out of the west rush against his face, and his hair streamed from his head. And he drank deep of that new air, and said, this uplifts the heart like the drinking of cool wine. But he knew not that the wind came fresh from the great sea. Now Tuor went on once more, seeking the gulls high above the river, and as he went the sides of the ravine drew together again, and he came to a narrow channel, and it was filled with a great noise of water. And looking down, Tuor saw a great marvel, as it seemed to him. For a wild flood came up the narrows and strove with the river that would still press on, and a wave like a wall rose up almost to the cliff-top, crowned with foam crests flying in the wind. Then the river was thrust back, and the incoming flood swept roaring up the channel, drowning it in deep water, and the rolling of the boulders was like thunder as it passed. Thus Tuor was saved by the call of the seabirds from death in the rising tide, and that was very great, because of the season of the year and of the high wind from the sea. But now Tuor was dismayed by the fury of the strange waters, and he turned aside and went away southward, and so came not to the long shores of the firth of Drengist, but wandered still for some days in a rugged country bare of trees. And it was swept by a wind from the sea, and all that grew there, herb or bush, leaned ever to the dawn because of the prevalence of that wind from the west. In this way Tuor passed into the borders of Nevrast, where once Turgon had dwelt, and at last, at unawares, for the cliff-tops at the margin of the land were higher than the slopes behind, he came suddenly to the black brink of Middle-earth, and saw the great sea, Belagea the Shoreless. And at that hour the sun went down beyond the rim of the world as a mighty fire, and Tuor stood alone upon the cliff with outspread arms, and a great yearning filled his heart. It is said that he was the first of men to reach the great sea, and that none save the Eldar have ever felt more deeply the longing that it brings. Tuor tarried many days in Nevrast, and it seemed good to him, for that land, being fenced by mountains from the north and east, and nigh to the sea, was milder and more kindly than the plains of Hithlum. He was long used to dwell alone as a hunter in the wild, and he found no lack of food, for spring was busy in Nevrast, and the air was filled with the noise of birds, both those that dwelt in multitudes upon the shores, and those that teemed in the marshes of Linaiawen in the midst of the hollow land. But in those days no voice of elves or men was heard in all the solitude. To the borders of the great mere Tuor came, but its waters were beyond his reach, because of the wide mires and the pathless forests of reeds that lay all about. And soon he turned away and went back to the coast, for the sea drew him, and he was not willing to dwell long where he could not hear the sound of its waves. And in the shorelands Tuor first found traces of the Noldor of old, for among the tall and sea-hewn cliffs south of Drengist there were many coves and sheltered inlets, with beaches of white sand among the black gleaming rocks. And leading down to such places Tuor found often winding stairs cut in the living stone, and by the water edge were ruined quays, built of great blocks hewn from the cliffs, where elven ships had once been moored. In those regions Tuor long remained, watching the ever-changing sea, while through spring and summer the slow year wore on, and darkness deepened in Beleriand, and the autumn of the doom of Nargothrond drew near. And, maybe, birds saw from afar the fell winter that was to come, for those that were wont to go south gathered early to depart, and others that used to dwell in the north came from their homes to Nevrast. And one day, as Tuor sat upon the shore, he heard the rush and whine of great wings, and he looked up and saw seven white swans flying in a swift wedge southward. But as they came above him, they wheeled and flew suddenly down, and alighted with a great plash and churning of water. Now Tuor loved swans, which he knew on the grey pools of Mithrim, and the swan, moreover, had been the token of Anael and his foster folk. He rose therefore to greet the birds, and called to them, marvelling to behold that they were greater and prouder than any of their kind that he had seen before. But they beat their wings and uttered harsh cries, as if they were wroth with him, and would drive him from the shore. Then with a great noise they rose again from the water and flew above his head, so that the rush of their wings blew upon him as a whistling wind. And wheeling in a wide circle they ascended into the high air and went away south. Then Tuor cried aloud, "Here now comes another sign that I have tarried too long." And straightway he climbed to the cliff-top, and there he beheld the swans still wheeling on high. But when he turned southward and set out to follow them, they flew swiftly away. Now Tuor journeyed south along the coast for full 7 days, and each morning he was aroused by the rush of wings above him in the dawn, and each day the swans flew on as he followed after. And as he went the great cliffs became lower, and their tops were clothed deep with flowering turf, and away eastward there were woods turning yellow in the waning of the year. But before him, drawing ever nearer, he saw a line of great hills that barred his way, marching westward until they ended in a tall mountain, a dark and cloud-helmed tower reared upon mighty shoulders, above a great green cape thrust out into the sea. Those grey hills were indeed the western outliers of Ered Wethrin, the north fence of Beleriand, and the mountain was Mount Taras, westernmost of all the towers of that land, whose head a mariner would first descry across the miles of the sea as he drew near to the mortal shores. Beneath its long slopes in bygone days Turgon had dwelt in the halls of Vinyamar, eldest of all the works of stone that the Noldor built in the lands of their exile. There it still stood, desolate but enduring, high upon great terraces that looked towards the sea. The years had not shaken it, and the servants of Morgoth had passed it by, but wind and rain and frost had graven it, and upon the coping of its walls and the great shingles of its roof there was a deep growth of grey-green plants that, living upon the salt air, throve even in the cracks of barren stone. Now Tuor came to the ruins of a lost road, and he passed amid green mounds and leaning stones, and so came, as the day was waning, to the old hall and its high and windy courts. No shadow of fear or evil lurked there, but an awe fell upon him, thinking of those that had dwelt there and had gone, none knew whither. The proud people, deathless but doomed from far beyond the sea. And he turned and looked, as often their eyes had looked, out across the glitter of the unquiet waters to the end of sight. Then he turned back again, and saw that the swans had alighted on the highest terrace, and stood before the west door of the hall. And they beat their wings, and it seemed to him that they beckoned him to enter. Then Tuor went up the wide stairs, now half hidden in thrift and campion, and he passed under the mighty lintel, and entered the shadows of the house of Turgon. And he came at last to a high-pillared hall. If great it had appeared from without, now vast and wonderful it seemed to Tuor from within. And for awe he wished not to awake the echoes in its emptiness. Nothing could he see there, save at the eastern end a high seat upon a dais, and softly as he might he paced towards it. But the sound of his feet rang upon the paved floor as the steps of doom, and echoes ran before him along the pillared aisles. As he stood before the great chair in the gloom, and saw that it was hewn of a single stone, and written with strange signs, the sinking sun drew level with a high window under the westward gable, and a shaft of light smote the wall before him, and glittered as it were upon burnished metal. Then Tuor, marvelling, saw that on the wall behind the throne there hung a shield and a great hauberk, and a helm and a longsword in a sheath. The hauberk shone as it were wrought of silver untarnished, and the sunbeam gilded it with sparks of gold. But the shield was of a shape strange to Tuor's eyes, for it was long and tapering, and its field was blue, in the midst of which was wrought an emblem of a white swan's wing. Then Tuor spoke, and his voice rang as a challenge in the roof. By this token I will take these arms unto myself, and upon myself whatsoever doom they bear. And he lifted down the shield, and found it light and wieldy beyond his guess, for it was wrought, it seemed, of wood, but overlaid by the craft of elven smiths with plates of metal, strong yet thin as foil, whereby it had been preserved from worm and weather. Then Tuor arrayed himself in the hauberk, and set the helm upon his head, and he girt himself with the sword. Black were sheath and belt with clasps of silver. Thus armed he went forth from Turgon's hall, and stood upon the high terraces of Taras in the red light of the sun. None were there to see him, as he gazed westward, gleaming in silver and gold. And he knew not that in that hour he appeared as one of the mighty of the west, and fit to be the father of the kings of men beyond the sea, as it was indeed his doom to be. But in the taking of those arms a change came upon Tuor, son of Huor, and his heart grew great within him. And as he stepped down from the doors, the swans did him reverence. And plucking each a great feather from their wings, they proffered them to him, laying their long necks upon the stone before his feet. And he took the seven feathers, and set them in the crest of his helm. And straightway the swans arose and flew north in the sunset, and Tuor saw them no more. Now Tuor felt his feet drawn to the sea strand, and he went down by long stairs to a wide shore upon the north side of Taras Ness. And as he went he saw that the sun was sinking low into a great black cloud that came up over the rim of the darkening sea, and it grew cold, and there was a stirring and murmur as of a storm to come. And Tuor stood upon the shore, and the sun was like a smoky fire behind the menace of the sky, and it seemed to him that a great wave rose far off and rolled towards the land, but wonder held him, and he remained there unmoved, and the wave came towards him, and upon it lay a mist of shadow. Then suddenly as it drew near it curled
and broke, and rushed forward in long arms of foam. But where it had broken, there stood, dark against the rising storm, a living shape of great height and majesty. Then Tuor bowed in reverence, for it seemed to him that he beheld a mighty king. A tall crown he wore like silver, from which his long hair fell down as foam glimmering in the dusk. And as he cast back the grey mantle that hung about him like a mist, behold, he was clad in a gleaming coat, close-fitted as the mail of a mighty fish, and in a kirtle of deep green that flashed and flickered with sea-fire as he strode slowly towards the land. In this manner the Dweller of the Deep, whom the Noldor name Ulmo, Lord of Waters, showed himself to Tuor, son of Huor, of the house of Hador beneath Vinyamar. He set no foot upon the shore, but standing knee-deep in the shadowy sea, he spoke to Tuor. And then, for the light of his eyes and for the sound of his deep voice that came, as it seemed, from the foundations of the world, fear fell upon Tuor, and he cast himself down upon the sand.
"Arise, Tuor, son of Huor," said Ulmo. "Fear not my wrath, though long have I called to thee unheard. And setting out at last, thou hast tarried on thy journey hither. In the spring thou shouldst have stood here, but now a fell winter cometh soon from the land of the enemy. Haste, thou must learn, and the pleasant road that I designed for thee must be changed, for my counsels have been scorned, and a great evil creeps upon the valley of Sirion, and already a host of foes is come between thee and thy goal."
"What then is my goal, Lord?" said Tuor.
"That which thy heart hath ever sought," answered Ulmo, "to find Turgon and look upon the hidden city. For thou art arrayed thus to be my messenger, even in the arms which long ago I decreed for thee. Yet now thou must under shadow pass through peril. Wrap thyself therefore in this cloak, and cast it never aside, until thou come to thy journey's end."
Then it seemed to Tuor that Ulmo parted his grey mantle and cast to him a lappet, and as it fell about him it was for him a great cloak, wherein he might wrap himself over all from head to foot.
"Thus thou shalt walk under my shadow," said Ulmo, "but tarry no more, for in the lands of Anar and in the fires of Melkor it will not endure. Wilt thou take up my errand?"
"I will, Lord," said Tuor.
"Then I will set words in thy mouth to say unto Turgon," said Ulmo. "But first I will teach thee, and some things thou shalt hear which no man else hath heard, nay, not even the mighty among the Eldar."
And Ulmo spoke to Tuor of Valinor and its darkening, and the exile of the Noldor, and the doom of Mandos, and the hiding of the blessed realm.
"But behold," said he, "in the armour of fate, as the children of earth name it, there is ever a rift, and in the walls of doom a breach until the full making, which ye call the end. So it shall be while I endure, a secret voice that gainsayeth, and a light where darkness was decreed. Therefore, though in the days of this darkness I seem to oppose the will of my brethren, the lords of the West, that is my part among them, to which I was appointed ere the making of the world. Yet doom is strong, and the shadow of the enemy lengthens, and I am diminished, until in Middle-earth I am become now no more than a secret whisper. The waters that run westward wither, and their springs are poisoned, and my power withdraws from the land. For elves and men grow blind and deaf to me because of the might of Melkor. And now the curse of Mandos hastens to its fulfilment, and all the works of the Noldor shall perish, and every hope which they build shall crumble. The last hope alone is left, the hope that they have not looked for and have not prepared. and that hope lieth in thee. For so I have chosen.
Then shall Turgon not stand against Morgoth, as all the Eldar yet hope, said Tuor.
And what wouldst thou of me, Lord, if I come now to Turgon? For though I am indeed willing to do as my father, and stand by that king in his need, yet of little avail shall I be, a mortal man alone, among so many and so valiant of the high folk of the West.
If I choose to send thee, Tuor, son of Huor, then believe not that thy one sword is not worth the sending. For the valour of the Edain the elves shall ever remember as the ages lengthen, marvelling that they gave life so freely of which on earth they had so little. But it is not for thy valour only that I send thee, but to bring into the world a hope beyond thy sight, and a light that shall pierce the darkness.
And as Ulmo said these things, the mutter of the storm rose to a great cry, and the wind mounted, and the sky grew black, and the mantle of the Lord of Waters streamed out like a flying cloud.
Go now, said Ulmo, lest the sea devour thee. For Ossé obeys the will of Mandos, and he is wroth, being a servant of the doom.
As thou commandest, said Tuor. But if I escape the doom, what words shall I say unto Turgon?
If thou come to him, answered Ulmo, then the words shall arise in thy mind, and thy mouth shall speak as I would. Speak and fear not, and thereafter do as thy heart and valour lead thee. Hold fast to my mantle, for thus shalt thou be guarded, and I will send one to thee out of the wrath of Ossé, and thus shalt thou be guided. Yea, the last mariner of the last ship that shall seek into the west until the rising of the star. Go now back to the land.
Then there was a noise of thunder, and lightning flared over the sea, and Tuor beheld Ulmo standing among the waves as a tower of silver flickering with darting flames. And he cried against the wind,
I go, Lord! Yet now my heart yearneth rather to the sea.
And thereupon Ulmo lifted up a mighty horn, and blew upon it a single great note, to which the roaring of the storm was but a wind flaw upon a lake. And as he heard that note, and was encompassed by it, and filled with it, it seemed to Tuor that the coasts of Middle-earth vanished, and he surveyed all the waters of the world in a great vision, from the veins of the lands to the mouths of the rivers, and from the strands and estuaries out into the deep. The great sea he saw through its unquiet regions teeming with strange forms, even to its lightless depths, in which amid the everlasting darkness there echoed voices terrible to mortal ears. Its measureless plains he surveyed with the swift sight of the Valar, lying windless under the eye of Anar, or glittering under the horned moon, or lifted in hills of wrath that broke upon the shadowy isles, until remote upon the edge of sight, and beyond the count of leagues, he glimpsed a mountain, rising beyond his mind's reach into a shining cloud, and at its feet a long surf glimmering. And even as he strained to hear the sound of those far waves, and to see clearer that distant light, the note ended, and he stood beneath the thunder of the storm, and lightning many-branched rent asunder the heavens above him. And Ulmo was gone, and the sea was in tumult, as the wild waves of Ossé rode against the walls of Nevrast. Then Tuor fled from the fury of the sea, and with labour he won his way back to the high terraces, for the wind drove him against the cliff, and when he came out upon the top it bent him to his knees. Therefore he entered again the dark and empty hall for shelter, and he sat night long in the stone seat of Turgon. The very pillars trembled for the violence of the storm, and it seemed to Tuor that the wind was full of wailing and wild cries. Yet being weary he slept at times, and his sleep was troubled with many dreams, of which naught remained in waking memory save one.
a vision of an isle, and in the midst of it was a steep mountain, and behind it the sun went down, and shadows sprang into the sky, but above it there shone a single dazzling star. After this dream, Tuor fell into a deep sleep, for before the night was over the tempest passed, driving the black clouds into the east of the world. He awoke at length in the grey light, and arose and left the high seat, and as he went down the dim hall he saw that it was filled with sea birds driven in by the storm, and he went out as the last stars were fading in the west before the coming day. Then he saw that the great waves in the night had ridden high upon the land, and had cast their crests above the cliff-tops, and weed and shingle drift were flung even upon the terraces before the doors. And Tuor looked down from the lowest terrace, and saw, leaning against its wall among the stones and the sea-wrack, an elf, clad in a grey cloak sodden with the sea. Silent he sat, gazing beyond the ruin of the beaches out over the long ridges of the waves. All was still, and there was no sound save the roaring of the surf below. As Tuor stood and looked at the silent grey figure, he remembered the words of Ulmo, and a name untaught came to his lips, and he called aloud, "Welcome, Voronwe! I await you." Then the elf turned and looked up, and Tuor met the piercing glance of his sea-grey eyes, and knew that he was of the high folk of the Noldor. But fear and wonder grew in his gaze as he saw Tuor standing high upon the wall above him, clad in his great cloak like a shadow out of which the elven mail gleamed upon his breast. A moment thus they stayed, each searching the face of the other, and then the elf stood up and bowed low before Tuor's feet. "Who are you, Lord?" he said. "Long have I laboured in the unrelenting sea. Tell me, have great tidings befallen since I walked the land? Is the shadow overthrown? Have the hidden people come forth?"
"Nay," Tuor answered, "the shadow lengthens, and the hidden remain hid."
Then Voronwe looked at him long in silence. "But who are you?" he asked again. "For many years ago my people left this land, and none have dwelt here since. And now I perceive that despite your raiment you are not of them, as I thought, but are of the kindred of men."
"I am," said Tuor. "And are you not the last mariner of the last ship that sought the west from the havens of Círdan?"
"I am," said the elf.
"Voronwe, son of Oranwe, am I. But how you know my name and fate, I understand not."
"I know, for the Lord of Waters spoke to me yestereve," answered Tuor. "And he said that he would save you from the wrath of Ossé, and send you hither to be my guide." Then in fear and wonder Voronwe cried, "You have spoken with Ulmo the Mighty? Then great indeed must be your worth and doom. But whither should I guide you, Lord? For surely a king of men you must be, and many must wait upon your word."
"Nay, I am an escaped thrall," said Tuor, "and I am an outlaw alone in an empty land. But I have an errand to Turgon, the hidden king. Know you by what road I should find him?"
"Many are outlaw and thrall in these days who were not born so," answered Voronwe. "A lord of men by right you are, I deem. But were you the highest of all your folk, no right would you have to seek Turgon, and vain would be your quest, for even were I to lead you to his gates you could not enter in."
"I do not bid you to lead me further than the gate," said Tuor. "There doom shall strive with the counsel of Ulmo, and if Turgon will not receive me, then my errand will be ended and doom shall prevail. But as for my right to seek Turgon, I am Tuor, son of Huor and kin to Hurin, whose names Turgon will not forget. And I seek also by the command of Ulmo.
Will Turgon forget that which he spoke to him of old? Remember that the last hope of the Noldor cometh from the sea? Or again, when peril is nigh, one shall come from Nevrast to warn thee. I am he that should come, and I am arrayed thus in the gear that was prepared for me. Tuor marvelled to hear himself speak so, for the words of Ulmo to Turgon at his going from Nevrast were not known to him before, nor to any save the hidden people. Therefore the more amazed was Varonwë, but he turned away and looked toward the sea, and he sighed. "Alas," he said, "I wish never again to return. And often have I vowed in the deeps of the sea that if I ever set foot on land again, I would dwell at rest far from the shadow in the north, or by the havens of Círdan, or maybe in the fair fields of Nan Tathrin, where the spring is sweeter than the heart's desire. But if evil has grown while I have wandered, and the last peril approaches them, then I must go to my people." He turned back to Tuor. "I will lead you to the hidden gates," he said, "for the wise will not gainsay the counsels of Ulmo."
"Then we will go together, as we are counseled," said Tuor. "But mourn not, Varonwë, for my heart says to you that far from the shadow your long road shall lead you, and your hope shall return to the sea."
"And yours also," said Varonwë. "But now we must leave it, and go in haste."
"Yea," said Tuor. "But whither will you lead me, and how far? Shall we not first take thought how we may fare in the wild, or if the way be long, how pass the harbourless winter?" But Varonwë would answer nothing clearly concerning the road. "You know the strength of men," he said. "As for me, I am of the Noldor, and long must be the hunger and cold the winter that shall slay the kin of those who pass the grinding ice. Yet how think you that we could labour countless days in the salt wastes of the sea? Or have you not heard of the waybread of the elves? And I keep still that which all mariners hold until the last." Then he showed beneath his cloak a sealed wallet clasped upon his belt. "No water nor weather will harm it while it is sealed. But we must husband it until great need, and doubtless an outlaw and hunter may find other food ere the year worsens."
"Maybe," said Tuor, "but not in all lands is it safe to hunt, be the game never so plentiful, and hunters tarry on the road." Now Tuor and Varonwë made ready to depart. Tuor took with him the small bow and arrows that he had brought, beside the gear that he had taken from the hall, but his spear, upon which his name was written in the elven runes of the north, he set upon the wall in token that he had passed. No arms had Varonwë, save a short sword only. Before the day was broad, they left the ancient dwelling of Turgon, and Varonwë led Tuor about, westward of the steep slopes of Taras, and across the great cape. There once the road from Nevrast to Brithombar had passed, that now was but a green track between old turf-clad dykes. So they came into Beleriand, and the north region of the Falas, and turning eastward they sought the dark eaves of Ered Wethrin, and there they lay hid and rested until day had waned to dusk. For though the ancient dwellings of the Falathrim, Brithombar and Eglarest, were still far distant, orcs now dwelt there, and all the land was infested by the spies of Morgoth. He feared the ships of Círdan that would come at times raiding to the shores, and join with the forays sent forth from Nargothrond. Now as they sat shrouded in their cloaks as shadows under the hills, Tuor and Varonwë spoke much together. And Tuor questioned Varonwë concerning Turgon. But Varonwë would tell little of such matters, and spoke rather of the dwellings upon the Isle of Balar, and of the Lysgarth, the land of reeds at the mouths of Sirion. "There now the numbers of the Eldar increase," he said, "for evermore flee thither of either kin from the fear of Morgoth, weary of war. But I forsook not my people of my own choice, for after the Bragolach
and the breaking of the siege of Angband, doubt first came into Turgon's heart that Morgoth might prove too strong. In that year he sent out the first of his folk that passed his gates from within, a few only, upon a secret errand. They went down Sirion to the shores about the mouths, and there built ships. But it availed them nothing, save to come to the great Isle of Balar and there establish lonely dwellings far from the reach of Morgoth. For the Noldor have not the art of building ships that will long endure the waves of Beleaguer the Great. But when later Turgon heard of the ravaging of the Falas and the sack of the ancient havens of the shipwrights that lie away there before us, and it was told that Círdan had saved a remnant of his people and sailed away south to the Bay of Balar, then he sent out messengers anew. That was but a little while ago, yet it seems in memory the longest portion of my life. For I was one of those that he sent, being young in years among the Eldar. I was born here in Middle-earth in the land of Nevrast. My mother was of the grey elves of the Falas, and akin to Círdan himself. There was much mingling of the peoples in Nevrast in the first days of Turgon's kingship. And I have the sea heart of my mother's people. Therefore I was among the chosen, since our errand was to Círdan to seek his aid in our shipbuilding, that some message and prayer for aid might come to the lords of the West ere all was lost. But I tarried on the way, for I had seen little of the lands of Middle-earth, and we came to Nan Tathrin in the spring of the year. Lovely to heart's enchantment is that land, Tuor, as you shall find, if ever your feet go upon the southward roads down Sirion. There is the cure of all sea-longing, save for those whom doom will not release. There Ulmo is but the servant of Yavanna, and the earth has brought to life a wealth of fair things that is beyond the thought of hearts in the hard hills of the north. In that land Narog joins Sirion, and they haste no more, but flow broad and quiet through living meads. And all about the shining river are flag lilies like a blossoming forest, and the grass is filled with flowers like gems, like bells, like flames of red and gold, like a waste of many-coloured stars in a firmament of green. Yet fairest of all are the willows of Nan Tathrin,